Hello and welcome to the Atlanta Opera Podcast, The Business of Opera. They say that there is no business like show business. But at the end of the day, though, it is still a business. And the question that we are interested in exploring here relates to the intersection of classical music and business. The sometimes impossible logic of non-for-profit, like opera companies and symphonies, and questions like, how does it actually work from a business standpoint? Are there ways to grow the business and make it more sustainable? How do we bring new audiences? What is the role of leadership as we continue to forge a path forward? The series is inspired by the programming of the piece, The Revolution of Steve Jobs at the Atlanta Opera in the spring of 2022. It is a brilliant and powerful opera that was written by Mark Campbell and Mason Bates, and premiered at the Santa Fe Opera in 2017, and then went on to win the Grammy Award. It tells the story of an iconic leader that stood right at the intersection of business and art, technology and design, and that is, of course, the character of Steve Jobs. In preparation for the premiere of the show in Austin, Kansas City, and in Atlanta, we will have a series of interviews with business leaders, opera impresarios, artists, and strategic thinkers, as well as creative minds who will focus on two themes. Number one, the business of opera and the role of leadership in this business. And number two, the very controversial and mysterious character of Steve Jobs and the opera written about him. I hope you enjoy the show. Hello and welcome to the Atlanta Opera Podcast, The Business of Opera. I'm here today with Michael Tushman, the legendary Harvard Business School professor, the former chair of PLD, the Program of Leadership Development, and now the current chair of AMP at Harvard Business School. So just a little background about my relationship with Michael. Mike was the chair of the executive program that I attended in Harvard, and to change my life forever and how I think about business. The time I spent in Harvard almost 5 years ago was the most impactful that I had as an adult. And there were so many wonderful people on faculty in that program, including professors Rohit Deshpande and Eugene Soltis. But one of the greatest influences on me was the critical thinking of Professor Tushman, and specifically his ideas and his writings and analysis of how companies should innovate, explore, and exploit, and become ambidextrous. It was so influential that when I came up with my TED Talk, I named it the Ambidextrous Opera Company in an homage to Michael's ideas. So first of all, Mike, welcome to our podcast. I'm so happy to see you. How have you been?
Great, Tomer. We have been surviving this pandemic both at home and on campus, and it is always great to work with you and your work with the opera.
I want to talk to you a little bit about your wonderful book, Lead and Disrupt.
Yes.
The second edition of the book that you and Charles O'Reilly wrote is released this fall, I believe. And the yes. basic premise there is this question of why do successful companies find it so difficult to adapt in the face of change, to innovate? And the answer has little to do with strategy often, or with technology, or even luck, but everything to do with leadership. And I love that, and I believe in that. So can you give us some examples, and there's many in your books, of how companies fail and how some companies succeed and why?
Let me give you some sense of the idea blocks. I'm going to give your listeners some sense of the idea blocks in our book. One is, as you just mentioned, Tomer, is the empirical fact is that most successful firms, either in the public sector or the private sector, in the face of outside either technical change or environmental change like COVID, don't do very well. So there's all this talk about innovation and agility, but the fact of the matter is most larger firms, most successful firms, by the way, whether they're large or small, don't fare well in the context of environmental shifts. That's point one. Point two, or sort of module two in our book, is that we have learned, or the field has learned, that dynamic capabilities, that is the ability of a firm, public or private sector firm, to live over time, is rooted in their ability to exploit their existing strategy better than anybody, and simultaneously explore into new terrains. Or to discover, like in the world of opera, partly your challenge is to discover what is opera going to be like before other opera companies do. Or I just did a piece of work at Deloitte Consulting. Old-fashioned consulting is not going to last long. And partly the role of senior leadership at Deloitte will be to discover that future before McKinsey, BCG, Bain, or IBM. So the second idea block is that dynamic capabilities is rooted in playing two strategic games well simultaneously. A game of fix the core, we call that exploit, and discover the future. And the observation, Tomer, is that those are inconsistent strategies, and that's fundamentally what we ask our leaders to do, is to live into paradox, live into contradiction, and live into the ability of operating multiple strategies simultaneously that are inconsistent. And our way to do that is this structural ambidexterity, where you separate out the past from the future, big from little, let a flower, 1,000 flowers bloom. And when one of them actually does bloom, you go to scale. And that's what Charles and I call ideation, incubation, and then going to scale. And what is kind of unique in our work is that there's a lot of academics and consultants talking about ideation and incubation. It's cheap. It's easy to incubate. It's really hard to go to scale. And that's what we really focus on, the leadership challenges of playing these games simultaneously, these inconsistent games simultaneously, and then every once in a while pulling the trigger and going to scale. That's sort of the sweep of our book. But at the end of the day, as you mentioned, Tomer, it's all about the leader and his or her team. And can they build a team that can handle contradiction? And finally, one other point, which is relatively new for our research, is their ability to live into an aspiration for their organization. That is, we aspire to be the world's greatest opera company. Or at HBS, it's we aspire to create leaders who make a difference in the world. Or at Children's Hospital in Boston, and I can barely say this, until every child is well. That is, these organizations that can live into these contradictions have leaders who are not embarrassed by passion, who are not embarrassed by clarifying their identity. And when you have a modestly abstract identity, until every child is well, it permits Children's Hospital to both explore and exploit way more effectively. So those are the key idea blocks in our book.
I love the idea of flowers that then can bloom and become the scale of the organization. And that is inherent with failure, right? Because you're not always going to find flowers. Often they're going to die before they're going to bloom. How about failure? Is that one of the reasons that companies are not doing this more?
Yeah, one of the big issues that Charles and I have found, and in our work in organizations, Charles and I and Andy Binns, is that frequently leaders, one, are embarrassed by passion, are embarrassed by identity statements, and two, don't want failure. And failure is frequently coded as a career-ending fault. And in our work on structural ambidexterity, the leader has to say to the exploit part of the organization, don't make any mistakes, failure is not acceptable. But to the explore part of the organization, the more failure, the better. Because you cannot learn without failure. And what I've just said is profoundly inconsistent. And that's what I ask my leaders to do, is to own that inconsistency, and in some parts of the organization, tolerate failure, and in other parts of the organization, don't tolerate failure.
Well, and what I love about it is that it translates to so many different businesses, right? Because here we are at the Opera recording a podcast, which is absolutely exploratory, but our main product, if that fails, if our production of Carmen or Traviata fails, then that can kill an organization. But
yes,
but absolutely. An exploratory product, which is digital in its nature, like the one we're having right now, is all about figuring out what works in a new world, and the world is always new. So yes, you have to continue to explore.
Yeah.
That brings me into linking business and Opera. So let's talk about Opera for a second. You wrote a case study about an Opera company that you still you still teach, not only at AMP, but it's still being taught at a PLD, and I think the MBA program is still teaching it. Opera is an art form that is at least 400 years old and is not what comes to mind when you think about innovation. So why did you write a case study about Opera?
We wrote a case study about Opera partly because it shows the challenges of leadership. We happen to have a great protagonist. His name is Tomer Zwolle, who takes charge of an Opera when it was not doing well. And the challenge for this protagonist was, can I continue to make the ABCs super great, old-fashioned Opera? But Zwolle knew that the future is not old-fashioned Opera. It's old-fashioned Opera and new stuff. And that's the exploratory stuff. These operas in the park, these cabarets, these podcasts are ways that you gut the Atlanta Opera to explore, to discover the future quicker than other opera companies. That even though the Atlanta Opera was a small not-for-profit, the challenges for you, the leader, both personally and organizationally, are the same as in my current Deloitte case. Deloitte is like $10 billion. The same issues for the leadership of Deloitte as the leader, the general manager of the Atlanta Opera Company. It is, how do you build your own personal renewal to live into that contradiction and build an organization that can do the ABCs as well as podcast well simultaneously? And it challenged, if I'm not mistaken, Tom, and you might want to talk about it, it challenged you in terms of your own leadership abilities to be able to share the stage with others who can help you build this robust and brilliant Atlanta Opera.
That's the only way to move forward, is to create a vision and have people that share that vision with you. And the interesting part about it is that those challenges never cease. You never arrive. You never stop, because it's ongoing and the world keeps changing. So you have to continue to keep changing and figure out what works in an ever-changing world. But that leads me into the inspiration for this podcast is Steve Jobs, and the fact that we are programming this season a wonderful new opera, and I hope, Mike, that you can come and watch the premiere, about the revolution that he created on so many levels, and his character and his life. And what absolutely fascinates me about Steve Jobs is that he's perceived in such an ambiguous way. There is a dichotomy about the perception of Steve Jobs. Some people think of him as an absolute monster, and some people absolutely idolize him. And to me, that's very operatic, by the way, because opera characters are all, the great opera characters are ambiguous. When you think about Mozart and Da Ponte, Marriage of Figaro, or Don Giovanni, or Wagner's Wotan, or Verdi's Falstaff, they're all characters that are on the intersection of being obnoxious and charming, charismatic and horrible. And Steve Jobs isn't like that. So your colleague, Charles O'Reilly, wrote a brilliant essay called Transformation Leader or Narcissist. And it's about a bunch of leaders like that, such as Steve Jobs, such as Holmes, such as former President Trump. And he has a very strong opinion against Steve Jobs, while others think that he is the incarnation of anything that is not human. He's a god. So, Mike, where do you stand?
I think that, so a part of my work with Charles is this importance of vision and identity and passion. And I think someone like Steve Jobs anchors the right-hand side of that vision, passion, identity. Some of your listeners would know Jean-Claude Bivet, the fellow who ran for many years the Swiss watch industry. He was like the Steve Jobs of the watch industry. Unbelievably passionate, in your face. And some loved Bivet and some hated him. What I really care about is, can individuals like Jobs or Bivet build themselves a team that can handle that kind of strong personality? I'm less concerned about Jobs as an individual or Bivet as an individual, but the people they surround themselves with. And if you surround, what we know is that narcissists surround themselves with yes men or women. The extent to which you are a big, bold, visionary, passionate leader and surround yourselves, like Bivet did, with people who were as bold and as passionate and as, you know, independent as he was, that works. And I think I, to some extent, disagree with my friend Charles. I think that Jobs probably individually was a narcissist, but he had around him people like Cook, who's no dummy, and he could push back on Jobs. So I think that's the key, is less whether the individual is or is not a narcissist, but is whether he or she can build a team around them that are collectively better than the individual. And I guess I think that's where I come out, that Jobs was able for a long period of time to be able to build a heterogeneous senior team, including one of his recent hires, or recent when I was still living, Joe Podolny. And Podolny's no dummy. And he would have the strength of character to push back at a Jobs. And Jobs would, by the way, didn't fire him. It didn't fire Cook. So that's where I come out on this operatic person called Steve Jobs, is a flawed, brilliant leader. But somehow he saved himself by his surround.
Let's start a little bit by telling us about your baby. The program that has been your baby for many years and that you have passed on, the program of leadership development, and then a little bit about the current program that you're chairing, AMP.
Both PLD, the Program for Leadership Development, and AMP, our Advanced Management Program, are comprehensive leadership programs, everybody, where we bring in executives from around the world and put them in intense pressure cooker environments for upwards of 6 months. Some of these programs are modular, like PLD. Some of them are integrated, where they're 7 straight weeks. But they all have the characteristics of attracting really heterogeneous groups of participants to the program from around the world, from the for-profit world and the not-for-profit world, and putting them in learning groups where they learn enormous amounts of work on leadership, innovation, change from their learning groups and from the faculty in the larger sessions. The only difference between PLD and AMP is PLD tends to be younger. I think its average age is about 36, where AMP is roughly 47. But they're all the same, bringing heterogeneous groups of executives to campus to learn from each other and to learn from the faculty.
And why is this program so unique and important?
I think these programs are important in that they are moments in time, just like you, Tomer, where seasoned executives, typically in a function, marketing, sales, manufacturing, product development, or opera, who want to move to general management positions, to actually run an organization. And these leaders know what they know, but they oftentimes don't know what they don't know. And at a moment in their careers, they're put together with a fantastic group of faculty who work together in an integrated fashion to deliver this sort of seamless program. But as importantly, they learn from each other. And I'm sure in your own particular learning group or living group, Tomer, you learned an enormous amount from your colleagues. So that mixture of faculty content and faculty engagement, living groups, intensity, where people are all in it together, makes for a really powerful learning experience at a moment in time. Our AMPers, it's really the same thing. These are senior leaders who are already general managers, and they have aspirations to move to the C-level. So they're country managers of, you know, Deloitte or Pfizer, and they have aspirations to be at the corporate level. It's exactly the same thing. They choose to invest in their own human capital. They invest weeks of time on campus with us and with their learning groups. And they transform. What we promise, and I think I promised that to you and your cohort in PLD, is both personal transformation and organizational transformation. And I think when people show up on campus, they expect organizational transformation. They expect strategy and accounting and marketing. They don't expect personal transformation. And that's what they get. And that's probably the biggest deal in these CLPs.
Yeah, and that would definitely be my experience. I mean, I would just, from my personal perspective, one of the greatest things about it is that it's not so much theoretical, because those are people that are on the ground, in the middle of running things. And what they're learning there is bolstering whatever struggles that they have as leaders. So I found it to be so incredible.
Let me add one more thing, Tomer, while we're there. Both in PLD and in AMP, I've done this enough to know that participants show up kind of as big shots. Here comes Tomer Zwilling. He's a big shot from the world of opera. And there are other big shots in the room. And they quickly learn, wait a minute, I'm not such a big shot. I got lots to learn from others. And once that big shotsky stuff goes away and they open themselves up to learn from the faculty and the participants, magic happens. And that to me is the secret sauce, is you bring in these great people and then put them in a context where everyone is teaching and everyone is learning. And oh my God, wonderful things happen.
Yeah, absolutely. I never felt as a big shot in Harvard because I was surrounded by all those folks from for-profit world, from Microsoft to Google, and I just felt like a little kid there. So, and it was an incredible experience. So thank you for that. And so COVID happens, 2020 happens, and we live in a coronavirus world, hopefully a post-corona world now, but I'm not so sure. At the same time, there's social justice unrest. There's a digital revolution. How are those three things playing into innovation? Are they going to help or are they going to kill us?
The issue of the day of 2022, of gender issues, diversity issues, issues of race, COVID, digital. These are striking leaders simultaneously. There's no more room these days for relying on your past wonderfulness. The world has shifted and has shifted fast. That puts this pressure on exploration. So this talk we had earlier about explore and exploit, man, in this world of COVID, Black Lives Matter, digital, big data, machine learning, boy, you personally and the organization has to learn quickly how to explore. And I don't mean just you, but including the Harvard Business School. My faculty colleagues have to learn how to teach differently. And we have to be comfortable where the world does not have to come to campus. I mean, for 100 years, you had to come to campus. Well, that's not so much, not true anymore. And it turns out we can deliver stuff online, as long as the faculty teach in a different way, really effectively. So the confluence of many discontinuities are putting pressure, I think, on every leader, on every organization, on the planet, and accentuates this issue of lead and disrupt that Charles and I talk about, of how do we continue to exploit whatever we have left to exploit, and even more importantly, how do we figure out the future, like in my Deloitte case, quicker than McKinsey or quicker than Accenture.
I love that. You know, my final question is coming back full circle to the way Steve Jobs changed the world, and that he was right on the intersection between art and technology.
Yes.
Between business and the highest quality of design. And as I think about listeners to this podcast, it's probably going to be folks from the opera world and some folks from business school that read the case study or that are following you, Mike. And I think it's a really interesting intersection because the art world should be learning and taking lessons from the business world. And at the same time, the business world should absolutely take lessons from the art world.
Yeah.
What is your view on that?
I think that to me, the brilliance of people like Jobs or Bevay is that they're not embarrassed by passion. They're not embarrassed by art and in love with art and not embarrassed by, you know, being a leader of a large organization. And those are contradictory. Usually artists do art and business people do business stuff. And they don't, I think the real geniuses out there are able to hold that personal contradiction. I am comfortable with my passion. I'm comfortable with my art. And I'm comfortable with being a leader of a large organization. My biggest issue with my AM peers, after I talk about the importance of identity, passion, vision, is I will frequently say to senior leaders, what got you into your profession, into your organization when you were younger was passion. You wanted to be a great physician. You wanted to become a great scientist. You wanted to understand the customer. But as you moved up into the organization, you've become this robot, this sort of strategy robot. And all that passion and all that artistry is gone. And I think what I say is those greatest leaders reconnect with that passion and resist the trauma of capitalism, if you will, to suck that out.
I love that.
But to own that contradiction and to be proud of it.
It reminds me of George Bernard Shaw said once that the reasonable man adapts himself to the world, but the unreasonable one persists in trying to adapt the world to himself.
Yes.
Therefore, all progress depends on the unreasonable man. And so
that's a great strategist,
right? And in many ways, Steve Jobs, people like Steve Jobs, was completely unreasonable. And the question is, do we have to be unreasonable to be innovative?
That's the sort of definition of the explore part of your organization and the explore part of your personality is to set expectations to do stuff that is inherently seen by the existing organization as unreasonable, impossible, or this is not what we do. And again, I want to underscore that. One of the big issues in organizations these days is this identity question. And the extent to which a leader says something unreasonable, it's frequently coded as it's not what we do. Like at HBS, we teach participants on campus. We don't teach them, you know, when they're thousands of miles away. And well, it turns out, why not? It's for a teacher in a public school. I'm smart, the kids are not. I lecture, I'm a sage on a stage. Well, that's not true these days. When you mess with professional and organizational identity, which any unreasonable leader does, you grapple with these identity dynamics. And that to me is one of the biggest issues for leaders, is to simultaneously be unreasonable and reasonable simultaneously. But it's the unreasonableness that's going to get you to the future. And that will always shake the identity of a firm.
I couldn't ask for a better punchline to finish this conversation. It's the unreasonable that's going to shake the organization. So, Mike, I can't thank you for all that you've done to change my perspective on the world and on business. And you've been a major influence on me. And I want to thank you for your time now and for everything you've done for me.
Oh, well, thank you, Tom. And let me just say sort of publicly, what makes me most proud of my work is not my research, not my writing, but my students and what they do in the real world. And what you have done and are doing in Atlanta are just totally inspiring. So I love it, Tomer. I look forward to this opening of the Jobs Opera.
Me too. I can't wait. Have a wonderful weekend. Good to see you, Mike.
Okay. Great to see you, Tomer.